Welcome to the Harry S. Truman Library and Museum. I'm Kurt Graham, the director of the museum, and it is a great pleasure to welcome you here on behalf of the Truman Library and the Truman Library Institute. We are pleased to sponsor this program presented by the American Public Square and KCUR 89.3. Tonight's program is the first in a series, Conversations at the Square, a four-program collaboration between American Public Square and KCUR 89.3. I'd like to welcome this evening's panelists, Governor Jim Douglas, Governor Ronnie Musgrove, and Ambassador Alan Katz. Thank you all for being here and for joining us tonight. Now, this is the rules of the game, so you got to start paying a lot of attention. That was the commercial. That's done. Now you got to pay a lot of attention because this is how this works. You received, along with the playbill, a question and fact check sheet. So if you have a question, please write it on the sheet and hold it up for a volunteer to collect. It will then be given to a roving reporter. And if the panelist makes a factual statement that you question, and you'd like to question that, please write down the statement, raise your hand, and your sheet will be given collected and given to a fact checker to check. Several members of the audience have civility bells. If you've been to an American Public Square program, you know all about this. There it is. Did you hear that?
That's how they sound.
That is the sound of civility right there. These bells will be rung if the tone of the conversation becomes less than civil. So that's what that is for. Now it is my pleasure to introduce our moderator for this evening, Brian Ellison. Brian is the host of the podcast State House Blend Missouri and a regular substitute host of Central Standard and Up to Date. He also contributes to KCUR news coverage, including political reporting, anchoring election night broadcasts, and conducting interviews for Innovation KC series. He has served in a variety of roles at KCUR since 2008, including as a producer of Up to Date and The Walt Lodine Show. So with that, I will turn it over to Brian for the remainder of the program.
Thank you very much, Kurt. You're already violating the no applause rule. Well, that's all right in this case. Welcome, very, very much welcome to all of you. It really is a privilege to be moderator of this event, although I have to say these are treacherous times for moderators. They come in for a lot of public critique, so I will trust that our three guests will behave themselves and my talents will not be too taxed in that regard. That's a legitimate concern, though, given the subject matter, right? We scheduled this discussion many, many months ago. it was not an accident to have the conversation now, with a few weeks before the election, but I do have to say I don't think anyone imagined just how each and every day would make this conversation more relevant. I don't think we could have imagined that the wheels would come off the wagon, in the minds of some at least, the civility wagon, that is. Some would say that race, the presidential race, while perhaps exceptional in the intensity of the incivility, is really only the latest manifestation of a narrative that has been unspooling now for a long time, and not just in that race. Let's take a look at this.
Eric Greitens is under attack from Obama's Democrat machine. They're trying to steal another Missouri election.
Hillary Clinton failed every single time as Secretary of State. Now she wants to be president. Hillary Clinton doesn't have the fortitude, strength, or stamina to lead in our world.
Hippo. Crit. One bellows malarkey. Donald Trump repeatedly says one thing, does another.
Tim Huelskamp's ugly smears against Roger Marshall. The desperate last gasps of a career politician. Newspapers say Huelskamp spreading disinformation, deliberately misleading. The dirtiest campaign Kansas has ever seen. That's Congressman Huelskamp's legacy.
Many just call him Lion Ted. Lied about Ben Carson to steal a win in Iowa. Lies about being the best for the GOP when polls show he can't even beat Hillary Clinton. His TV ad about John Kasich? Lie. Stations had to pull it off the air. If Ted Cruz's mouth is moving, he's lying.
Chris Koster, just another self-serving politician putting himself first.
And both support letting transgender men go in little girls' bathrooms.
Dr. Roger Marshall almost ran down and seriously injured his neighbor and fled the scene of his crime. Lawbreakers belong in jail, not Congress. Roger Marshall, not who he says he is.
Republicans in Congress are just standing by him. But shouldn't they really be standing up to the bully?
The Clintons. From dead broke to worth hundreds of millions. So how did Hillary end up filthy rich? Pay-to-play politics. Staggering amounts of cash poured into the Clinton Foundation from criminals, dictators, countries that hate America. Hillary cut deals for donors, sold out American workers, exploited Haitians in need. She even handed over American uranium rights to the Russians.
Well said. Well said. Yeah, this is not a Saturday Night Live sketch. Those were all real ads from just this year. Our hope tonight, though, is not to be consumed by just this present year or this present election or even by campaigns at all, although I have confidence that that will come up, and it should, and you're welcome to ask questions about it. But I hope that we're able to get beyond and behind this present state of incivility, beneath it, to try to unearth some of the history of this pattern, and seek to discern its causes, to uncover its roots. And in so doing, maybe we will even catch a glimpse of where the future could lead, maybe even where some solutions might lie. Let me ask first James Hawley Douglas. Governor Douglas spent his entire career serving the people of Vermont. After serving in the State House, including a term as its majority leader, he went on to be elected Secretary of State and State Treasurer, and in 2003 became the 80th governor of Vermont, serving from 2003 to 2011. That's 4 two-year terms. Governor Douglas presided as a Republican over what Gallup says is the country's second most liberal state. But could you have handled Massachusetts, is the question.
It's where I was born.
There you go. Governor Douglas shepherded and signed many bipartisan pieces of legislation in that state, including comprehensive health care reform and economic growth programs. These days he writes and speaks and is executive in residence at Middlebury College. Governor Douglas, how in the world did that work? Why, in a word, were you able to be reelected repeatedly, even when on a variety of topics, you didn't match your fellow office holders, didn't match the legislators, didn't match maybe even the majority of voters in your state? What was going on in Vermont that allowed things to be so civil?
Well, I think the nature of a small rural state like Vermont lends itself better to civil discourse and politics than perhaps a broader scale, larger states, and the national stage. It's retail. People get to know their elected officials and their candidates, even for statewide office. They're very likely to run into a gubernatorial candidate at the dump or the grocery store or school play or a forum like this, as opposed to just seeing that person on TV. So when negative ads are run, and they're not quite as bad as what we saw earlier, they are incredible because people get to know folks personally and quite well. And most Vermonters are pretty independent. We're deep blue, as you suggested. Our electoral votes are not in play, I think it's fair to say. But the last 10 governors have been of alternating parties, and there's a very competitive race this year in which a Republican may well be elected. So I think it's the personal connections that people establish that allow us to get over some of the hurdles that other people face. And I worked well with not every time, but with Democratic legislative leaders to accomplish some of the goals that I set forth and about which I feel very good in terms of accomplishment. So we just seem to get along better.
Well, on the other hand, Ronnie Musgrove was the 62nd governor of Mississippi. And he's a Democrat who presided over what Gallup says is the nation's number one most conservative state. Well ahead of Alabama, by the way. These days, he's a principal at Musgrove Smith Law Firm. Governor, I think it's fair to say that your term saw economic growth. You had a very high level of civility in the work that you did with legislators there. But I suppose there's something else we should say that almost any governor would say at the end of their term. There was still work left to do. Poverty, education, health, statistics for Mississippi, lag behind national averages. There's always more work for governors to do. Begs the question, why do you think civility is such a virtue anyway? Why would we not celebrate a tough talker who gets things done more than worrying about civility?
In Mississippi, we have celebrated people who were tough talkers and were not that civil, to be quite honest with you. But for me, I thought it was important to focus on policy. You know, when the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate and others would say, we don't want to change. We like the way we're doing it. And my response would be, if we were first, second, or third, that'd be fine. We're 50th. 50th. Don't you think a little change would be good? I'd be for trying a little change. And so people are uncomfortable with change. I wish I could say that the future would bode well for us to stop the discourse the way it is right now. But it doesn't appear that way to me. I think the press and all of us to some degree like too much conflict, too much drama. It makes for more TV, more valuable print, etc. And so I think that's where it has driven us to where we are right now. I don't think anybody would have thought a presidential candidate like Donald Trump, who just went through what he went through this past weekend, would even be standing as a candidate. That would be the same thing if it were a Democrat as well during the course of a campaign. But today, we look past all of those things, or in some regards, allow those things to happen. And as you know, that's a big difference from the way it was, Brian, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago.
I want to come back to that, too. But first, let me introduce Ambassador Alan Katz, founder of American Public Square, former U.S. Ambassador to Portugal. Alan's been an attorney and a legislative aide for members of Congress. He's been around this a long time. These days, he's a distinguished professor at UMKC as well. Alan, American Public Square is not the only one of these civility projects to come along. There have been authors writing books about civility. I remember interviewing someone 7 or 8 years ago who had something called the Civility Project. I remember those TV commercials that showed like Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich sitting together on a love seat. You know, there have been lots of efforts at civility, and yet it isn't working. Even with all the effort, even with some well-funded hard work by a lot of really smart people, it seems to be getting worse, as Governor Musgrove said. Why is that?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. First of all, the reason that we believe American Public Square is different is because we don't frankly think that any change in this is going to happen on a top-down basis. You know, my notion really is that there are the people who continue to behave the way they behave are people who believe that will perpetuate them in this position that they're in. And that ultimately people in the community and people have to sort of say to them, say, no, that's unacceptable. We're no longer going to keep reelecting you. We're not going to continue to do this because we have demonstrated that you can have conversations about really tough issues among people who don't agree with each other. And it can be civil and it can be fact-based. Now, the fact of the matter is it doesn't sometimes make for as much fun for television. And I think that, you know, someone mentioned earlier about the media, and not to put too much blame on them, although one of the nice things tonight about being a panelist and not being a moderator is I can be a little more candid, is that if Donald Trump had not attracted the amount of attention that he attracted through the whole primary process, I don't know what would have happened in terms of the outcome. But the reason was he was willing to say the most outrageous things, and television was willing to cover all of these most outrageous things, and basically other more thoughtful Republican candidates were kind of like, oh, there was no oxygen left in the room for them. And so we never heard from them. When I say we, I mean the population in general. And I think that what happens is this. I think the reason I do this, and the reason that we began American Public Square was we believe that we need to somehow get this back into a more rational order. We believe that it is possible. We believe it's really tough. But I always tell my friends, you know, who say, isn't this a Sisyphean task that you've taken on here? I always sort of say, you know, if I had told you all 5 years ago that gay marriage would be the law of the land, you would have told me I was crazy. And when all the candidates who were supporting the war in Iraq in 2004, except for Howard Dean, went out throughout the countryside, by November that year, they were all against the war, because what happened was they found out that the people in this country, or certainly in the Democratic Party, were opposed to it. So I think that what we have here is a task. We have to move towards a tipping point. I don't know where that tipping point is, but I'm at a point in my life where I try not to spend too much of my time on things that I think have no future. So hopefully this is going to work.
Very good. All right. So you've met our three guests throughout the evening. As Kurt said, you have the opportunity to ask questions by writing them down on those question slips. In this room, obviously, it's a little difficult for Stephen to get to you, so it'll be probably easiest for you to pass those slips to the ends of your row, and where the people on the end, we will impose on you to kind of hold them out or up so that Stephen can see you with them.
I could body surf into the middle of the row.
Yes, if you want to pass, you can pass Stephen down your row, or you can pass the slips out to him, and he'll be circulating as we go along. Gentlemen, this week, several commentators, too many to cite, in fact, used a phrase that I kept noticing them using. We've hit a new low, is what they said. And they were referring, at least when I saw it today, to a comment from Donald Trump's campaign CEO, Steve Bannon, responding to reports that more women are accusing Mr. Trump of sexual assault. And Bannon said the campaign would, quote, go nuclear and, quote, turn Bill Clinton into Bill Cosby. A new low, though, is a phrase we've heard before. It seems like we keep hearing that phrase. My question to you, and to your point, Governor Musgrove, are we really at a new low? Is this really as bad as it's been? Do you really think politics were more civil at an earlier point, or are we being falsely nostalgic? Is it just that we have more access to what people are saying that used to be in rooms with the doors closed? Maybe our memories are just short. Is it really worse than it used to be?
Jim?
Well, hard to know. We weren't around two centuries ago, but there were certainly a lot of very uncivil comments tossed around in presidential campaigns of the past. The Jeffersonians called John Adams, among other things, a hermaphrodite. Later on, Rutherford Hayes was accused of shooting his own mother and stealing pension funds from Union soldiers. And, of course, the famous accusation that proved to be true, that Grover Cleveland had fathered a child out of wedlock, didn't keep him from winning the presidency. So there was certainly a lot of talk and accusations going around, but I think the real difference is the media. The fact that these can be tweeted and retweeted and broadcast on 24/7 news, so-called news stations, and I think the access to the repetition of these allegations makes it seem a lot worse than it used to be.
You guys agree?
I do agree. And let me say something about Jim, that the question was asked a minute ago, how did he work with all those Democrats in Vermont? Having known Jim for a long time and having beaten a good friend of mine, who I served as lieutenant governor with from Vermont, who I thought was a good guy, Jim is really a good guy. And you can disagree with him, and I do disagree with him on policy, but he is a prince of a fellow. And that makes all the difference in the world when you're trying to tackle difficult issues. But I think where we are today, presidential elections historically are just kind of like normal elections. We will swing back and forth from Democrat to Republican. We will react to what's going on. I think the tone and tenor of campaigns, likewise, are the same way. And what has happened over the last, if you look at it in modern times, we've reached a new low in modern times, Brian, because for all of us, we think of like the last 50 years. I think what we really think about is the Nixon-Kennedy debate. And from then till now, kind of how's it been? And certainly we're dealing with issues today that we didn't deal with back then, but so is society. Talk to children, watch TV, listen to what's going on, and you see in a lot of ways a presidential campaign simply reflecting society. The one last thing I will also say about that is, I think Bill Clinton said it some time ago, as he said, one of the most segregated places that we have is the place we get our news. And the segregation of news, to me, creates a very bad atmosphere. If you're very conservative, you get your news from Fox. If you're very liberal-leaning, you get your news from MSNBC. And so what happens is it a lot of news that is no longer news, it's opinion news. And we take opinion news as though it's factual news. And it simply reinforces our position, whatever our position happens to be. And I think, to me, that's one of the big disservices, because people never hear, as they watch news, what kind of person the other person really is.
You know, let me just jump in. I agree with what everyone has said here. I recall that back, I think it was in the late 50s or early 60s, a commentator asked Richard Nixon, well, shouldn't all the liberals join the Democratic Party and all the conservatives join the Republican Party? That seems to be where you're going. And Nixon said that would be terrible, because then think of the consequences of these elections if one party was only one and one party was only the other. And I think that what has happened is that we have allowed the different parts of the parties of both sides to dominate it and drive wedges to the point where if you are a Republican and you are a pro-choice Republican on the issue of abortion, you have absolutely no business, you will have no chance to ever run for president, and you may have no chance to ever run statewide. At the same time, if you are a pro-life Democrat, with one or two exceptions, the same thing is true. We've allowed that issue, among others, to so define people that what has happened is it is kind of pulled apart. Now, there are a lot of different ways of trying to do something about that. In fact, I wanted to ask my friend from Vermont, because I think he vetoed a bill that would have addressed that issue. I was reading about it in the New York Times the other day. I didn't know about it before. That one of the methods was to sort of say, okay, you would vote for a first, second, and third choice when you voted. And what would happen is that way people who were more extreme right or more extreme left, basically, through that voting process, you would figure out a winner, but you would allow people who didn't like either candidate, perhaps like this year, they would vote for someone else first, and the question would be second and third. Such a bill, I understand, passed in Vermont, and it was, Jim, you vetoed it, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but I'm curious as to what your thought process was, because it struck me as at least one approach to somehow getting past this sort of partisan pull that we have today.
This is the ordered choice for candidates voting system.
Yeah. It has different names, but you're right. A preferential voting, sometimes they call it, where you indicate on a ballot your first choice, your second choice, your third choice. I don't think that's the answer, frankly, to a legitimate concern that we've been talking about. I served a dozen years as Secretary of State, which, of course, is in most states the chief elections officer. So I got to work with local officials a lot on ballot counting and see the incredible contortions that people had trying to mark a ballot. And my reaction was, it's hard enough the way it is. I mean, thousands of spoiled ballots every year because people can't just make an X next to the name of a candidate they want to vote. So to get them to write numbers on a, I think would be, I'm sorry to say, but very, very challenging. But philosophically, I guess I don't like it. I think an election ought to be a real-time choice between or among candidates, and not a hypothesis. Like, if this candidate weren't in the race, whom would I like? So I just think it's not the right choice. There was a little ditty that was going around at that time saying, if you like me and I like you, won't you be my number two?
I don't know. But how romantic. Yeah.
In a manner of speaking, I guess. But could I amplify a point that Alan made? Because it's very important. There was a United States senator from Vermont named Ralph Flanders who served in the 40s and 50s. He wrote a memoir called, it's not a flashy title, Senator from Vermont. But he talked about the point you made. He, by the way, was the senator who sponsored the resolution to censure his fellow Republican, Joe McCarthy, from Wisconsin. But Flanders said the strength of the parties is their diversity. And he said nothing ever passed around here, this is from 47 to 59, without strong support from both sides of the aisle. Incredible. But a half century ago, that's the way they worked in the United States Senate, and I hope through the American Public Square effort and others we can get back to that.
But can I follow up on that, though? I mean, sure. Does that mean that the key to civility is more moderate politicians? Governor Musgrove, you were a fairly conservative Democrat, at least as you governed Mississippi. Did that contribute to your civility? Do you have to not be at the edges of the political spectrum?
I'm not sure. I think it's more important for the electorate to be somewhere in the middle. I've always said you govern much more effectively from the middle. But the way in my description of the news, the way people get their news, and the way that we do things, we're all pushed to the extremes. Yet we need more people in the middle. Now, I'm still pretty progressive in spite of the fact that I was deemed to be conservative. I felt like we needed a new flag, a different flag in Mississippi. I thought that our flag did not represent the future of Mississippi. Now, needless to say, I was way ahead of my time. and you can rest assured that I paid a price for that. But I wouldn't go back and change that. In spite of that position, I felt like there were some things that we needed to do that were concrete things that could move us forward, that would, in fact, increase the quality of life, bring better things to our state. And I feel like that sometimes what you have to do is you have to be strong, and sometimes if you ask the legislators, they would say I wasn't that nice and conservative and everything because sometimes I had to take them on to make changes.
Yeah, let me just sort of, my recollection is this. Back in the 70s, I worked on Capitol Hill. And in those days, what happened was the Democrats had the majorities in the House, and they'd had it for a long time, but they had a lot of Southern Democrats. So they didn't have enough votes, really, among Democrats to pass things. So they would go to Bob Michael, who was the minority leader, and they would work out some kind of a deal with Midwestern Republicans, Northeastern Republicans. They were Northeastern Republicans in those days. And what happened was is that, you know, the people who the Democrats didn't get everything they wanted, and the Republicans participated in shaping a lot of the major bills that became law. And what happened in 94 when the Republicans took over, there were two important things. Number one, up until that time, there was this notion that somehow nothing was going to change the complexion of the House. The House was going to be Democratic forever, which, of course, wasn't true. Number two, when the Republicans took over, the leadership had a new approach, and their approach was, we're going to pass every bill with just Republican votes, which means we need 218 Republican votes on every bill. So two things happened. Number one, there was suddenly this idea that if I leave from my party, it could affect the outcome in terms of who's in charge of the House, which had never even been part of the consideration before. And secondly, what happened was is that you drove your party leadership made sure that everyone who was elected, everyone sitting in the House, understood what the program was, and basically deviating from that meant primarily they would find someone to run against you in a primary, raise money for that person, and defeat you. And unfortunately, I'd like to sort of say that the Democrats never did anything like that, but that wouldn't be true. So what happened was is that that became the new culture in the Congress. And unfortunately, I don't think it's changed for the better.
Could I add to something Ronnie said? First of all, I want to reciprocate on the compliment. Obviously, the people of Mississippi saw an intelligent, principled executive and chose him, despite the red complexion of the state, to provide leadership, and that says a lot about his integrity. But you talked about the polarization of the electorate based on media, and there's another phenomenon that several academic journals have been writing about over the last couple of years, and that's what they call ideological transmigration or ideological migration, where people are moving to live in areas with people who think as they do. So we're polarizing ourselves by where we live. I mean, I run into people in Vermont who say, I'm new here, and I engage them in a conversation. Well, where'd you come from? Why'd you decide to come? And, we heard about this leftist nirvana here that we wanted to be a part of. And, and the same thing, obviously, is happening in the other direction in other parts of the state. And I don't think that's at all healthy. I think communities are better when they're more diverse, where there are differences of opinion, and people can engage in a civil discussion of those differences. But we're doing it to ourselves.
How many here know someone who has moved to one side of the Kansas-Missouri state line or the other for ideological reasons? I do actually know a number of people who have made choices like that. Stephen, you have some questions for us?
You won't be surprised. We've been here, a half an hour, and I already have dozens of questions. But let's start with something you just spoke about recently. This is a question: what would reignite congressional engagement across the aisle? It seems the partisans will punish elected leaders for showing, quote, weakness in the form of collaboration. Along those lines, Tim from Kansas City asks here, with alternate voting systems on the ballot in Maine and Governor Johnson polling among 30% amongst millennials, do you think that a move past a two-party system could increase some civility in campaigns? I put these questions together because I think there's something here. And finally, last but not least, do we have any prominent examples of civil debate today in the political arena?
I want to come back to that last question because those signs of hope, I think, are something we need to end with so we're not depressed when we leave tonight. But
good plan.
But I do want. I think that's an excellent
question.
Keep hope alive.
Yes,
indeed.
Sorry, that was partisan.
How do we reward legislators and others who are willing to reach across the aisle, who are afraid to do that for fear they'll be punished at the ballot box if for looking too conciliatory?
You know, let me just sort of suggest a couple things that are happening now that are going to be very interesting to see. Joe Heck, who is the Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate in Nevada, has disowned his support of Trump. He's in a very competitive race. I mean, it was probably a three-point race one way or the other. And so the question is, are the Trump voters going to punish him, and is he going to lose? And which is a very interesting phenomenon that a lot of these people are going through. You'll see people who sort of said, okay, I'm disowning Trump, and then saying, well, maybe not so fast, because of the politics that are involved. But I would suggest that there's something else that could happen. I don't think it will happen, but I would hope it would happen. I think what's going to happen probably is the House will remain in Republican hands, but the margins will be very much smaller, which gives Paul Ryan a very interesting choice. He can either allow the Conservative Freedom Caucus to make sure that they determine everything he does, or he can go back in time about 20 years and sit down with the Democrats, assuming he can find some Democrats he can sit down with, and sort of figure out a way where basically you can have more bipartisan approach to some of these things. I think Ryan in his personal district would have no problems. Whether or not he would remain Speaker of the House is something that is, you know, but this is not a job he sought. So I think let's just say this. I think Paul Ryan is in a unique position to do something really significant to change this, but I think it may be expecting too much for him to do it. I don't know what you guys think about that.
Well, Brian, when you say that people would work across the aisle in Congress, or if they didn't, they would be punished by the electorate. The truth of the matter is, according to what Alan said, which I think is correct, no, you're punished by the leadership of your own party. It's the leadership who will go get an opponent for you. That's where you're punished, and it's all up close and personal. Now, I don't know enough from a congressional standpoint to say one way or another, but one of the things that caused civility and the ability to work together was when the chairman of the committees had wide discretion to hand out a lot of various things that helped various districts. Now, you can call that what you want to call it, but they had an ability to bring votes. They had ability to bring things to the table. Now you have no ability to bring anything to the table. Joe over here, Jim, they do not get anything for voting that way, so why not take a hard line? That's another thing I think that has caused the polarization internally. And then the other thing is that watch the talk shows. You know, I think Fox started this, and I'm not sure about that. I don't mind the fact checkers here. I'm really sad is when my children got an iPhone and had the ability to fact check things that I told them. That was the difficult thing. This won't be difficult tonight. But if I'm right about the fact that Fox started it, it's not exclusive to Fox. You listen to almost any talk show, and everybody is kind of yelling over each other in the discussion. And you don't really hear the good, the bad, or the indifferent. That's what I found was so interesting the other night in the vice presidential debate. They debated somewhat like you would normally see a conversation around the table, and I think they were criticized the most for interrupting each other. Now, isn't that a dichotomy to what we normally listen to and watch and accept as being okay? But I think because of that idea of I'm going to stand up and be tough in the debate part, we don't get to the real issue. The last thing I'll say, Jim, and then I'll turn it over to you, the last thing I'll say is that 50 or 60 years ago when Walter Cronkite told us how it was a simple 1, 2, 3. And that's the complexity of our life. Today there's so much information coming at us from so many different directions, it's hard to decipher what's real, what's not, what's right, what's wrong. And you hear people from all stripes saying everything about each issue, so we don't know. And I think that uncertainty causes that much more of a problem because we're uncertain because of what we hear.
I guess a couple of thoughts. The new senator, relatively new senator from Maine, Angus King, former governor, had a suggestion that I think is just brilliant, and that, of course, renders it impractical. But he said, the problem is we don't get to know one another around here. And I've been on flights with my congressional delegation. They fly down Tuesday. They fly home Thursday. Actually, Senator McConnell is now scheduled to vote late Monday, so he's pushing the calendar just a little bit more. But King said, what we should do is not do this three-day-a-week thing. We should come here for 3 solid weeks, including weekends, and then go home for a week. And there was a time when the members of Congress and their families used to go on an excursion. They'd get on a train, go up to rural Pennsylvania. They'd have a weekend of family activities, barbecues, softball games, and they don't do that anymore. They don't talk to each other. They don't like each other. And I chatted with my own congressman recently, and he said, I don't even know all my fellow Democrats, just the ones who are on my committee. So we've got to get them to talk with one another. I saw it in the state capitol. Maybe Ronnie did as well. When you have dinner with somebody or lunch, you're probably going to temper your rhetoric just a little bit if you get to know somebody. Second point I'd make is congressional districting, gerrymandering. The system is a little different in every state, but in most cases, politicians draw the district lines, so why wouldn't we expect them to be political? There are some states that have nonpartisan commissions. I'm not sure everybody's nonpartisan on every commission, but it's an effort to try to get it out of the political realm. Iowa has a great system. It's essentially done by a computer. I mean, that's a slight overstatement, but they put in the demographic and geographic and other commercial pattern districts. And so several members in Iowa and California have run against each other in the last couple of cycles. But if we can get that less partisan to craft districts that work well for the party in power in each state, maybe we'd get more centrist members.
Yeah, I think that, the thing about gerrymandering that I always sort of find to be, puzzling is that we've had it forever. I mean, it's not like this is some new phenomena, okay? But they've been gerrymandering since, I think the term comes from somebody who was someone whose name was Gary or Jerry, and that they basically wrote through the lines around the late 1890s or 1900. So this is an old problem. Now, with the age of computers, they can do it a lot better. It's a lot more sophisticated. But the other thing that Ron referred to a moment ago that I wanted to sort of go back to, Bill Bishop wrote a wonderful book called The Big Sort. And in the book, he points out that in 1976, about a quarter of Americans lived in counties that were so-called landslide counties, which means that they voted by 20% or more for one party or the other. By 2004, half of Americans lived in those counties. And today it has to be worse. And so really what does happen, again, going back to your point, which is, you know, if you are liberal and you want to live, you live among liberals, you go to a church or a synagogue or a mosque among liberals, and you watch MSNBC and you probably read the New York Times, and after a while you think that your opinions are facts. And the same thing is true if you're a conservative, except it's Fox News and it's something else. And, you know, I'm always going to come back to the wonderful quote of Daniel Patrick Moynihan, which was, we're all entitled to our own opinions, we're just not entitled to our own facts. But the problem is that, again, we used to have Walter Cronkite in the evening news. That was our common well of facts in this country. And then we would all argue about what they meant. And the reality is this, and what I think the point of what we try to do, and I think the biggest problem we have on civility is that it's not even so much that we disagree. It's that we characterize the motives of the people with whom we disagree to be the worst possible motives. And I think that's what leads to the sort of real difficulty in terms of people getting together.
So then what do we do about that specifically, this media segregation, as you said? Because the reality is that that's not something we can wave a magic wand and change. The world has changed. There's going to be dozens and dozens of media sources available to everyone at every moment now in perpetuity. So what do we do then? How does that change, or do we just complain about it?
I think one of the ways it does change is from what Jim and Alan just mentioned when you talk about gerrymandering. And while it has been around a while, it has not been used to the point or the extent that it has been used over the last 30 years. But I remember when the first redistricting took place in Mississippi, where they packed, and I was opposed to it, they packed almost all of African-American citizens into single districts. So the theory was, at least the opposition said, we would elect more African-American senators in the Senate. And they were right. It increased the number. But it also produced a lot of 95% white districts. And they were mainly Republican districts. And so if I'm a Republican with a 95% constituency and I watch Fox News, why should I even have to go watch MSNBC? If I had a district that had much closer comparable 60-40, 55-45, then I've got to look and be considerate of everyone. And if I start yelling and being uncivil to people who look differently than I do or who think differently than I do, I might very well get voted out of office just with a little bit. And so I think the gerrymandering fix could, in fact, cause the discourse to be much better because the elected official would then listen, would have to be to listen, which I think is important.
Stephen Steigman.
You may not be surprised to know that you hit on a really big topic here, which is media coverage of elections and politics in general. And I think I've kind of condense them all down to this one from somebody here in the audience. Do you think that by being outrageous, talk show hosts are creating very loyal audiences so that they can keep them and use those numbers to make very profitable advertising machines? And along,
that certainly has worked for me on KCUR.
Exactly. I mean, see, I don't mind asking a question like that because I feel that we're not part of that. But furthermore on this, any thoughts on the idea that moderators seem to sow the seeds of conflict with baiting questions? That one comes from Bob Tomek from Lee's Summit. I hope I pronounced your last name correct, Bob.
Say, what about this for an answer from a political person? Yes. Yes.
Go on.
Well, it's not just the moderators. Look at Dr. Phil. Just listen and look at any and everything that's on TV. That is exactly what they do. It's either the media is causing us to be that way, or we're ensuring to the media that we really are that way, and that's what we want. We want constant conflict in almost anything we see. I don't buy that as a theory, but it's much simpler to have a 10-second soundbite for something than it is to give some complicated, detailed idea. You know, one of the things that we were always asked, it didn't matter what we trotted out as an idea. A standard, fair question that we were always asked by the media, how much does it cost? Where are you going to get the money? Seemed pretty sensible to me. I'm not sure that question has been asked by either presidential candidate on any issue they've put forth. I have no idea if you adopted Hillary Clinton's plan or if you adopted Donald Trump's plan, which one would have a bigger impact on the budget, because no one has looked at or even thought about or maybe cared about it.
So my question about that is, is civility being drowned out because there is no substance and so the incivility rises up to fill that vacuum? Or is it, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? Is there in fact no substance leading to the incivility, or is it the opposite? Is the negativity so powerful that it's crowding out the substance, that our candidates really do have plans and policies that would be very satisfying if they could only get those in beneath all of the civility that instead dominates the airwaves?
I'll give the same answer, yes. Mm-hmm. I think it is both. Ratings drive compensation for these celebrities and revenue to the networks. There are so many options out there. They have to distinguish themselves, and that generally means by being louder and more noticeable. And so it does, I think, inflame the discourse that we're all concerned about. I guess on the question of moderators, Lincoln Douglas, no relation, back in 1858. Debated with no moderator, and I kind of think a moderator ought to be like an umpire. If he or she is too obvious, then it's not working right. I'm going to have them without any today, but I think sometimes they do overstep the line.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is this: look, we live in a celebrity culture, and I think that in some ways the Donald Trump candidacy is kind of like bringing forth what came out of the movie Network, for those of you that remember seeing it long ago, and the idea that somehow this would sort of take over things in the way that it has, and I just really think this. I think that the only thing that I've been able to think of, aside from trying to do things like American Public Square and other programs like that, I think that Democrats need to be a lot tougher on Democrats, and Republicans need to be a lot tougher on Republicans. Because if Democrats attack Republicans, it's just immediately written off as a political attack, has no basis in fact, and has to be batted back. But if those of us with our respective parties demand a higher standard of behavior from our own people, that resonates. Because we're the ones who they really need in order to stay in office. Because it becomes so immune, really, any Republican criticism of Hillary Clinton or a Democratic criticism of Donald Trump, if you think it means anything inside of those campaigns, then you're living in a different world than I am. It's water off a duck's back. And I think that somehow when you look at people, in fact, you'll see both campaigns react more when someone in their own party, when Paul Ryan is doing what he's doing with Donald Trump really reacts to that. When David Axelrod said something about something with Hillary Clinton, that campaign reacted. All I'm trying to say is that that's, to me, is kind of like, okay, that's the tell, and it has to happen not during a campaign. It has to happen every day after a campaign.
Alan, I think that we'll see whether that's been productive or not for, say, Republicans to disagree with Donald Trump. And there have been a good number, probably more than I've seen in recent times, to disagree with the presidential candidate. Where we'll really see if that was effective, will those people be punished at the ballot box by the people who supported Donald Trump later on? If they are punished, then they'll say, that wasn't a really good idea. If they're not punished, then maybe it'd be okay. But I agree with you that there is a line sometimes as a Democrat that I simply look at another candidate and I say, I can't, this person's not qualified. And that will get you in trouble, but if a person is just simply not qualified, you know, you need to be able to say something about it, or your credibility is brought into serious jeopardy, it looks like to me. And the last thing I'll say about that is while I am a big Hillary Clinton supporter, and I try to be as objective as I can, you may disagree with the way she has tried to present ideas or platforms or plans. But by doing so, what is the knock on her? She doesn't connect. She doesn't have the charisma. She's not fiery enough. She's not reaching people. And yet she's doing the thing, I think, that we talk about wanting to do, but at the same time, it doesn't resonate. Now, on the other hand, Donald does a great job with a 10-second soundbite. Now, I'm not quite sure what he's meaning by everything, but he does great, and it gets covered. But as far as any substance behind it, there's not a lot in terms of how much it costs. How do you get there? How do you accomplish it? But those are not the questions we're really asking anymore.
It's going to be great. Just don't worry about
okay.
it.
Okay. it'll be fine.
You know, you're
it's the Republican on the stage, folks.
You're exactly right, though. I mean, you got to be true to yourself. And the Republican who's running for governor of Vermont this year, and the reason he's in a competitive race is he said months ago, I'm not voting for the guy. And some reporters pushed him and asked, well, what are you going to do? And after a few demurrals, he said, I'm going to write in Douglas.
So he's your guy, huh?
I think you might get a few more votes here tonight, Jim. I don't want us to totally ignore the video we watched at the start of this event. We showed a series of negative or very negative campaign ads, some by candidates, others by PACs and other outside groups. Let's be honest, negative ads work. That's why those all were made. That's why they're on TV. It's difficult to imagine them stopping as long as they keep working. My question is, how do you, if you can't change the content of the message as long as it's still working, how do you change then the minds, the hearts of people who apparently are eating that message up?
Well, let me just jump in for a second. I want to get back to the question on the media and sort of tie it to this.
Well, it's related, yeah.
I think that what happens is this. I think that the media has decided that they would rather be an umpire with ratings than to take on any civic responsibility. And I would argue that particularly television, and the social media is something that I know is important, and I'm just too old to understand it. But as far as television is concerned, it seems to me that all these television stations, number one, they get their licenses from the federal government. They're not charged for the licenses, and they basically are allowed to make money based on that license. It seems to me that somewhere along the line, they have a civic responsibility to sort of say, okay, let's take those ads up there. We're going to tell you what's right about it and what's wrong about it. They don't have to say who to vote for, and all I'm trying to say, that's probably not the best way to do it, but my point is that somewhere they can say, we're not going to cover these kinds of speeches that are inflammatory. We are going to sort of push people more. Then it won't happen at once, and it's so difficult to do, but somewhere along the line, someone out there who has the ability to reach millions of people has to assume some responsibility from the substantive standpoint. Because otherwise, I mean, Brian, you're right. The reason those ads are run is because they work. The moment you know when you'll find stop seeing when you don't see any more negative ads, you'll know they're not working anymore. And I think that the question really is that we have to figure out a way to push back as a society. Otherwise, we just sort of figure they're all a bunch of you know, they're all a bunch of crooks, they're all a bunch of losers, and basically why would we want to, we don't really care, and therefore we drift towards being a Republican or a Democrat based on what our normal inclination is, and we just figure it doesn't really matter.
Governor Douglas?
Well, the press can do that. In small ways, I've seen it happen. There was a reporter in Vermont who told me that he was criticized directly by some politicians through the years for not covering certain staged events and speeches and rallies and things. And his answer was, I'm going to cover this contest as I see fit and get to the substance of things, not just all the puffery. So it can happen, but it has to happen more. The Republican presidential nominee is pretty good at persuading the media to come to an event, and they show up. So whether it's what he advertised or not, and continues to get away with it. But that only addresses coverage. It doesn't address the commercials that you showed, Brian, and I don't know what the answer is. I mean, we value the First Amendment and the right to say almost anything that somebody wants to. I think in the end, the American people just have to demand better and reflect that in whom they support and the decisions that they make. That perhaps is naive, but I think we get the media and politics that we collectively deserve.
Is it naive?
Yes, it's naive, but still, for those of us who have a love for our country, we have a love for our state, a love for our community, we want better. We hope for better. Part of one of the things that the media could do, and it looks like to me, say, for instance, in the presidential debates, is that before the debates start, you could look at what's happened the last 4 years, you could do from think tanks or whatever, but you could say, here are the five issues, or the four issues that's facing the country. And tonight, or earlier than that with the campaigns, you are expected to state your positions on these. And if they will not, then you will be roundly criticized by everyone. So that you at least force the candidates to take some positions somewhere on the issues that matter. And I think that that would help some, but it would not be too much of an infringement that a lot of people could argue about in terms of, you know, we run a campaign the way we think we ought to be able to run a campaign. Yeah. That being told.
Yeah, we have a lot of questions out there. Stephen?
You know, it's funny, Brian, you should bring up ratings, because I just got a call from Nielsen Ratings, and they say that this evening's broadcast is in the toilet because we're not being controversial enough. So I need you to ask some more leading questions.
It's also not live, so that would be another reason.
Oh, he called me on it. Okay. So I'd like to change the subject here slightly to the role of social media. We have this question from Katie Crow from Lenexa, who asks, what role do you feel social media, you know, Facebook and Twitter, and among others, have played in the increased polarization of political parties? And along those same lines, we have a kind of a question here statement. What's the best course of action, speaking of social media, what's the best course of action to take when a true believer refuses to accept facts in a discussion, yet they insist on talking or typing about politics consistently?
To that question of when you have different sets of facts, what do you do?
First of all, if you're dealing with the social media issue, I think the jury is still out as to whether it has increased polarization or not, whether it has increased knowledge or just given a platform to speak and be heard. And all of those are distinctly different. And I don't think that we have looked at it and analyzed it enough to see how it has shaped elections heretofore. I could make an argument on any of those positions, but I don't have any facts to back it up. So it's no need of getting into that. But I think that we'll figure it out, and I think that political people will use social media in a much more targeted way in the future. Now, as it relates to non-political, just expressing yourself, it's still going to take a long time on that.
I think that most, from what I see, As someone who just admitted he doesn't understand social media, I have an opinion on it, though. No, I think essentially it's very.
Don't worry, we're going to post about this. Yeah.
What's that?
I
mean?
Think essentially it's very tribal. I think that rarely do you wind up having a what I would call a civil conversation back and forth in social media with someone with whom you disagree. Usually, people are calling if you run across something with which you disagree. Usually you say something relatively unpleasant, and the response is in kind. There are a couple groups out there that are trying to do something about that, but I think they're having some success. But I think what's happened really is that we just don't find, we've not yet figured out a way. And actually, it's one of the things with American Public Square we're trying to wrestle with is how do we take the social media, which we know is part of, an essential part, particularly of younger people, and how do we get them into the mode that we're trying to get this conversation in? And finally, you know, I think it's impossible to talk about, mention Twitter in this campaign without talking about Donald Trump. Essentially, it is unprecedented in this country, perhaps in the world, where someone running for the office of President of the United States at 3 o'clock in the morning is sending out, you know, Twitters that are essentially attacking someone out there. And again, attacking your opponents may be good old-fashioned politics, but his field has gone much wider than the people that he's running against. And it's just, and what the social media really does do for a lot of people, it gives people in this country a voice which they never had before, which has some positive benefits, but it also gives every extreme group access to a lot more people than they ever had before. And so what happens is that I think we're still working our way through all of this, and I don't think there's any good solution other than the fact we need to be recognizing the impact it's having on our daily life.
Of course, all the rest of the media then report on those tweets, so it gets reinforced and broadcast. I confess I'm mired in the 20th century as far as all this stuff is concerned. In my last reelection campaign, my staff said, "You got to have a Facebook page," to which I replied, "Probably a whole what?" And so I looked at it once, I think. And then I was at some event, and a young boy came up to me and said, "Governor, Governor, it's me, Billy, your Facebook buddy." Yeah, Billy, yeah, yeah. But I can confess all this. I'm not running for anything. But I think, Ronnie, intuitively, it would seem to me it is making a difference. It's another way of conveying a message with whatever edge the author wants to put on it. So I have to believe that it is exacerbating this whole problem.
How's your Snapchat account? I'm just kidding.
Well, since you brought this up, interesting story. Somebody opened a Twitter account in my name, like 4 or 5 years ago, and I'm glad that they monitor that and police it. And apparently, it started off with some very plausible comments, and then got increasingly less so, and so they shut that down. So now I have a Twitter account. Just to protect my name, but I've never used it.
I noticed that when I was preparing for this evening.
Yeah, don't send me a note.
You know, I do want to ask, there are times in the life of a public servant, a governor or another politician, that you're going to do things, and you're going to do them out of conviction, maybe even out of courage, that are going inevitably to lead to some incivility in the kind of response you get. You go into it probably knowing that. I know each of you have had examples like that. Governor Musgrove, you've already mentioned your decision to pursue changing the flag of the state of Mississippi. Governor Douglas, you vetoed same-sex marriage in Vermont. Your veto was overridden the next day by the legislature there. But each of you took these steps as acts of conviction on very hot topics that you knew incivility would likely follow.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that experience and what that says for a conversation about civility? Sometimes you have to court incivility because that's what's, in your view, right to do.
Yeah, for the record, I was in agreement with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama then on that topic. So it wasn't out of the mainstream. But obviously a hot-button issue. Many people who advocated for the bill were quite respectful and civil. Others weren't. I saw public hearings with larger crowds than we're accustomed to in our little capital city. And there was some fairly uncomplimentary banner with my name on it that was displayed from a building in downtown Burlington afterward. But I thought, you know, you just do what you feel is right and life goes on. And I think it's particularly noteworthy that the polling that was done after that showed essentially no change in my favorability rating. So I think Vermonters respect people who take positions that they may or may not agree with, and we make a decision and go on to the next issue.
I wish the people in Mississippi would do that. they don't always do so. You know, I also had a couple of situations where we had not had a death penalty execution for 13 years before I got into office. So pretty much most of my political career, I had been in the Senate for two terms and lieutenant governor, and we had not had an execution. So we had an execution that came along, and it got near the date, and so I had a lot of ministers, priests, and a lot of people kind of marching on the governor's mansion to try to get me to not let the execution go through, and I met with a lot of people. And, of course, there was a lot of news coverage. And finally, my son, about 14, called me one day, and the day before this was supposed to happen, and he said, "Dad," he said, what is all of this stuff? We haven't talked about this, but what is all of this about this guy that they're going to execute this week?" And I told him, and he said, "They say you're the only person that can stop that. They said, his life is in your hands." And he said, "What if President Bush came down here and said, 'No, we're not going to do that'?" I said, "He can't do that. It's a state crime and not a federal crime." And it was a long pause, and he said, "This is serious stuff." And it is. There are a lot of situations, and I said, my concern was he guilty? This is our law. Are we satisfied he was guilty and everything was done correctly? And it took place. I stayed the next execution because I did not think it was done correctly and that there was an issue before the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court said it was unconstitutional to execute someone that was in that person's position. Now, there was not one person on my staff who wanted me to do that. But I said, I can't go home and sleep at night if I don't feel like I've done what I think is the right thing and what I believe is the right thing. Now, other people will disagree with me for that, but I've got to feel comfortable with that. And it was the same way with the flag. It probably created, Brian, as much animus against me in the state as anything that I could have done. But I knew that our economic development had increased dramatically for the positions we were taking. We had passed some of the best legislation that we'd ever passed during that term. And I didn't feel like we ought to go backwards in terms of our future. And so as a result, I knew that. It was a conscious decision, but I felt like it was in the right position for our state to take.
Sure, glad we have a cow and a pine tree on our flag.
Not been a lot of controversy over the Vermont state flag, has there? No.
But now Brian, I will say as a follow-up, there were lots of people that looked at me and said, "I can't believe you did that." I never once got into a shouting match with anybody. Had many opportunities, and then even since I've been out of office. But I think it's important for people to understand that I have a position. And I remember when I was in the Senate one time and there was a controversial vote on whether we should have a lottery. And I voted on it, and there was a Republican constituent in my district that wrote a letter. It was about a 3-page, single-space type letter about how crazy I was. And this person was very smart. I responded back with a 5-page, single-space letter. He then wrote a 7-page, single-spaced letter, and I concluded the conversation with a 9-page, single-spaced letter. He called me up and said, I want you to come see me. I did, and he said, I'm going to start supporting you. He said, at least you understand why you took the position you did, and you could back it up. And he was one of my best supporters for the entire time that I was in office. And it's just, he appreciated at least that I had thought through the situation.
That is a great story. Steven Steigman, one more round of questions. From
yeah, I've had a couple of questions about, a lot of questions about media you might answer, you might suspect. But here's one. Do you think there, this is from Reed from Kansas City, Missouri. Do you think there's a correlation between levels of incivility and feelings of disenfranchisement with politics? And after that, I've got a what I've been looking for all night, some possible solutions in my left hand.
You were definitely going there.
Yeah,
a link between disenfranchisement and incivility, sense of disenfranchisement.
Yeah, I think clearly if you feel disenfranchised, if you feel you have no stake in the process, why would you not want to tear down the process? Because basically you've got no skin in the game. And I think one of the things that needs to happen, and I mean this, not just the people who have been classically and historically kept out of the process or given less access to the process, but I mean, there's a large number of people in this country who have just stopped believing that anything their government does is worthwhile, and they cut across the gamut, and somehow we need to figure out a way to start talking to them.
There are more people in that category, I think, than the ones who really feel disenfranchised, like they don't really participate. We participate, we vote, we're a part of it, and then nothing happens. And it doesn't matter who we vote for or who we send,
right.
Nothing happens in Washington. And I'm not trying to say it's all bad in Washington and all of the state houses, it's all fine. I think more and more people feel that way, and I think that's the biggest part of the anger that you see across the country, is that we're just fed up with Washington from whatever perspective or directive that you come from.
That's exactly right, and that's what's fueling both the Trump and my junior senators' enthusiastic supporters over mm-hmm. the past few months, and why some of their rallies have become uncivil. Ronnie's exactly right. People look at Washington, D.C., and they see a dysfunctional federal government that didn't pass a budget for 4 years, that spends more time naming post offices and passing resolutions of condolence than anything substantive. It's no wonder Congress's approval rating is 13% or whatever it is now. And so they are attracted to candidates who voice that frustration, that sense of disenfranchisement, and that's certainly what we've seen dramatically this year.
It's funny to think of Bernie Sanders as the junior senator.
Well, I mean, that's ironic, Brian. The outsider, he's been there a quarter of a century.
So I do want to get to that other question, and the question that we've been sort of... it's been itching to be answered throughout the evening, which is, when you survey today's landscape, do you see any signs of hope? Are there positive examples among national leaders or others who you think have found a way to model civility and be effective? Where do you look for positive signs?
Well, okay, just a couple things. First of all, there are a lot of organizations like American Public Square. They're different, but going after the same thing in communities all over the United States. There literally are thousands of different groups that are trying to figure out a way to make things more civil. And it's a very disconnected group. It's actually what I would sort of, it's really part of a movement, because there's a lot of feeling about in the country that people really are unhappy with this level of civility. But the problem is this, is that in back in the 60s, for those of you who were alive when I was, if you were against the war, you knew where the movement was. If you were involved in the civil rights movement, you knew where the movement was and who the leaders were. If you were involved in the women's movement or student power, whatever it was, Now, what do you do if you're just frustrated with all this stuff? You don't really have any place to go. And so that's one of the reasons we exist. And I think a lot of other places around the country are starting to try to create that space, if you will, for people to come. And the question is whether or not we are smart enough to figure out a way how we galvanize that so that the politicians do understand that something's going on.
Again, if you use Washington as an example, I would hope that the leadership, and I don't know at what point in time the leadership is going to say the country is turning on us if we don't do something. But if the leadership in Washington would come up with three items that they think are major issues for the country that if we don't resolve or attempt to resolve them in a bipartisan manner, it's going to be bad for the country. And there are a lot of those you could pick out, to be quite honest with you. Notice every time that we have either a natural disaster or some, you look at 9/11, you look at when bad things happen, we can unite. And what we need to do is take the things that will create bad situations and unite around resolutions of those things. And if we can show that Congress actually has resolved some of those issues, then it gives some hope for us moving forward in a civil, I think, a better discourse.
There have been some efforts. The Simpson-Bowles initiative a few years ago that I think was a squandered opportunity, frankly, to move forward with a bipartisan consensus with a lot of people out of their respective comfort zones, but a common agreement on most fiscal issues. The Domenici-Rivlin plan came along a little later, and I've been working a little bit with the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington that tries to bring folks together and have these civil discussions, an organization founded by Senators Dole, Daschle, Baker, and Mitchell some years ago, who saw that the institution they formerly led has deteriorated. And so they're trying to, the three who are still living, trying to show some leadership there. And I think the states, you mentioned the states, Ronnie, I think things are better at the state level and for all of our challenges. Only one state that I can think of shut down state government in recent history, whereas the federal government does it all the time. I think they are much more functional, some with mandatory limits on their session and balanced budget requirements and so forth. So maybe the states can present some examples. And I guess one other specific thought, Brian, we have to have a little controversy here. I've never supported term limits, but I'm warming to the idea now that I'm out.
I noticed that.
No, we don't have them in Vermont, but I decided 8 years was enough and somebody else ought to have the opportunity. But in Washington, they just go there and they stay forever. And our Vermont has never, you can check this, never unseated a senator elected by the people of Vermont. Come on. They can't all be that great. So I think maybe some forced turnover, most governors are half of them roughly are limited, right? And some legislators are. I think that might help. How much worse could it be?
Well,
and that's what a great final word that is. I want to say thank you to the Truman Library for hosting us. Thanks to the folks from American Public Square, especially Jeff Fendorf and Kim Jacobs and Alan's team. Thanks to my KCUR colleagues, Ron Jones, Steven Steigman, Mike Russo, who put together the video, and Matt Hodapp, who's helping with engineering tonight. And thanks most of all to our panelists. We're going to air this on KCUR's Up to Date sometime between now and the election. Do we know when yet, Steve?
We don't have a specific date.
The senior producer does not
sometime,
yet know.
This means you'll just have to tune in every day to
you'll
find out.
You'll just have to listen every day.
We're going for the ratings, folks.
Please join me in thanking our panel tonight.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian, and thank you to our panelists. I think if there's a takeaway tonight, it is that civility is not a function of ideology. It is not a function of party. it is a function of character, and I think we've seen that displayed very, very amply here tonight, and I thank you for that. I think the greatest compliment I could pay you here is to say that you are Truman-esque in your approach, and I appreciate that very much.